What does it mean to be peacemakers? What is Christ encouraging or affirming?
To deal with conflict in a healthier way. I mean, that, I don't see the assumption, especially throughout his ministry, there's all kinds of conflict that happens. So it's not to avoid conflict, but to deal with it in healthy, non-destructive, non-retaliatory ways.
I think when I think about the process of peacemaking, rather than I think of not necessarily reconciliation, but in the process of working things out, you have to understand the other person a little bit better, at least get some sense from where they're coming from, about where they're coming from. You may not understand them, but I think peacemaking has something to do with understanding or getting to know the other person's viewpoint a little bit.
So, understanding.
Understanding the stranger, because usually somebody that you want to make war with is a stranger to you because you don't understand them. Not a stranger in the sense that you've never met them, but.
Well, yeah, but we know each other quite well in families at times, and we even know which buttons to push and everything.
Right.
Well, that's what I mean, but I'm not saying you don't know them, but I'm saying you don't understand them. If you're going to fight with them.
There is a quotation in Corinthians that says that our God is not a God of confusion, but a God of peace. So it sets peace at loggerheads with confusion. I was just looking for it, and I can't bring it to mind where it is or where it is. So.
And is conflict resolution, does that capture what you were saying, or is there a better way of putting it?
That sounds a little much like a program in a business these days.
Better that than, how to swim with the sharks without getting eaten as an approach to business.
Yes, a peacemaker has listening skills and accept the person where they are and honors the person for the way that they're thinking and the way that they're feeling, does not put them down.
Well, Jesus didn't do that on a number of occasions.
What's that again?
Well, when he lays into the whitewashed sepulchres and everything, it doesn't sound like he's just sort of honoring them for where they are.
Well, there's a difference between making a statement in that way as opposed to raising to the bait somebody throws at you. A peacemaker does not rise to bait. Is able to analyze why something's been said or done rather than just responding emotionally. And that's different than making a point in a sort of violent way. So.
Now, one of the things that helps me relate to instances where Christ, picks up the thong in the temple, is to step back and understand what are the power relations. If he was in charge in some fashion, or if he had some authority or power over people, it might be a different story. But most of those times, he wasn't invading into someone's space. He was, and in fact, it seems clear that he had told people in other kinds of ways, and they weren't hearing. And so he would say something in somewhat more dramatic fashion, more prophetic fashion, if you will. It's really hard to find violence in...
No, it's not violence, but it's not just sort of... I guess I was reacting to the sense of just sort of accepting them where they are, and I don't think that's true. I just don't... Well, I think it's one thing to understand where a person is, and then to sort of accept that.
Okay.
So it's how you resolve the conflict. You can accept somebody for where they are, and then if you have the freedom to express where you are, and if you can accept each other's points of view, you go from there and you can do some negotiating and agree with things that you both agree with. Or if you're a third party and you're mediating between two people, you're directing and help to facilitate resolving the conflict.
Think of examples like Christ and the rich man, where there was, I think we can see both understanding and accepting. I mean, or understanding and loving, maybe.
He loved.
But there's something more than just understanding. He seems to reach into people's hearts. And if they're at all receptive, I mean, he's right there where they're at in his dialogue with them. That the famous one where he's writing on the ground when people want to stone the prostitute, and you remember the story?
Woman caught in adultery.
I'm sorry?
She wasn't a prostitute, she was caught in adultery.
Caught in adultery. Thanks very much. I'm sorry. I was thinking ahead to the to another piece that I heard, really a great kind of addition to the story that I heard, which I'll share with you. But he ends up saying, you know, those, the person that's not guilty of any sin, cast the first stone, right? And a fairly well-known feminist theologian asked the question, what do you suppose he was writing on the ground? Was it just sort of drawing? And she says, I think I know the answer. They're having this trial, they're going to stone the man, the woman. He just might have been writing, where is the man?
Oh, yeah.
Often in his ministry, he seemed to break through the stereotypes of gender or class or race or ethnicity. You know, pick a Samaritan and he'd be the hero of the story. I mean, for Pete's sake, you know. Many feminist theologians have come back to fill out the details of a perspective on Christ as astonishingly sort of modern, if you will, or trapped in classic roles in his time. I mean, for just to take one example out of many, if the early Christians had wanted to convince anybody that Christ really rose from the dead, they would never have women be the first people to discover that he was gone, because women's testimony wasn't even valid in their courts at the time. And that's just one of many stories that you can tell of the gender roles being turned upside down. And it's just kind of amazing that Christianity was able to take such a detour back into sexism and take so long to come back out, given the revolutionary character of the period. I mean, hundreds of years had to pass, and people had to forget the social context to be able to misunderstand so much of the biblical record, and to be able to go to, for anybody to tolerate going back to as sexist structures as we had in so-called Christian societies.
And always still have them.
And yeah, we're hardly out of the woods. So, blessed are the peacemakers. I'm going to get off the track a little bit. I'm tired enough. I hope you'll pull me back in, that this isn't really off the track in my view. I mean, the more I think about it, not only was I delighted to hear us begin with a notion that doesn't limit this to like international conflict. Us are the peacemakers who go to Bosnia, you know, and try to resolve a conflict. I mean, we're talking about conflict, the whole spectrum, from interpersonal, even intrapersonal, to community, to within the church council might be an interesting place to look, within a state or nation, and internationally as well. But also between racial and ethnic groups, between classes, between genders, etc. Christ, and the text that's the theme for the summer that was read again the other night is just amazing. I mean, it's rooted in a very specific moment or specific occasion of saying, you know, both the people that came out of the Jewish tradition and those who were Gentiles are equal. But it's obvious that that kind of reconciliation was meant to apply to everyone. We are all home. It ends, at least the passage that has been read several times. And that means non-Christians too. It was clear that it didn't just mean the people that are already decided. And look at all the people that Christ said, this person illustrates the kingdom of God. And there was no traditional kind of narrow Lutheran demand that they first confess all their sins and ask for forgiveness and say that Jesus is Lord. I mean, the centurion hadn't done any of that. He was on the way there, but he had grasped the gospel in some fashion that is, you know, undeniable and in the biblical text. And so did many, many other of the stories of people who made it. I mean, it's not just a situation, as some would have it, that, you know, evangelism is the first and foremost function of the Christian in relation to others, but rather living as Christ lived with people who hadn't already come to the faith. I mean, and oftentimes even holding them up as having the answer. It's a really interesting and challenging, and I think liberating perspective on who we are and also how we relate to others.
I think it relates to this question you asked about peacemaking, and you referred to the Ephesians text, and of course, how does this peace come about? It's through the cross. So it's at least an apparent failure and great pain. And maybe we need to remember that sometimes. So it can be extremely difficult.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of the Bonhoeffer quote. Actually, there were a couple of them that we discussed on Monday. Solely because God became a poor, suffering, unknown, successless man, and because from now on God allows himself to be found only in this poverty, in the cross, we cannot disengage ourselves from people and from the world. For this reason, we love our brothers and sisters. For the meaning of history is tied up with an event which takes place in the depth and hiddenness of a man who ended on the cross. The meaning of history is found in the humiliated Christ. And it doesn't necessarily mean that one is a martyr, although that was the end of more than a few Christians. It certainly doesn't mean you choose that, or that you say, just because you're suffering, you must be on the right track. I know people that say, you know, we'll do something badly, and people will attack them for it, and then they'll say, well, you know, that's Christ promised us that was going to happen, you know. And I want to say, well, maybe, maybe not. Well, let me take a little different tack, because I think this is a really important corner of the sort of whole that Christ means when he says, blessed are the peacemakers, you are children of God. Another part of what Christ was talking about is that I think Christ came to understand and is sharing with us and built his ministry on and the future church on a revolutionary way of even understanding conflict and power. One that not only is more moral in some sense, but actually works better. There's a marvelous book, came out a couple years ago by one of the leading ethicists at Union Seminary, Donald Shriver. It's entitled, An Ethic for Enemies, Forgiveness in Politics. And he observes that we've reduced forgiveness pretty much to the interpersonal dimension. And he's saying, You know, there's ample evidence in history, whether it's the Civil Rights Movement or something as complex as U.S.-Japanese relations before and during and after the World War II, or the Holocaust. I mean, he takes a very wide range of very challenging contexts to examine the power of forgiveness in political worlds, not by, you know, humble Christians in their white robes waiting to be martyred, but by hard-nosed political leaders who understood that even though I represent an offended people in some conflict, my reaching out first, before my oppressor is willing to reach out, and in effect forgiving so that there can be a bridge that extends out, works better in the world.
Nelson Mandela seems to have done some of that as he's, you know, taken the reins of power.
Amazing.
And then he's just kind of assumed these symbols and images and whatever that have belonged to the white power.
The library just purchased the book of Desmond Tutu's writings, and the lead essay is worth the price of the book alone. The Rainbow People of God is the title, and it's the story of, and it includes the letter that he wrote 10 years before Nelson Mandela became president to his arch enemy, de Klerk. And it's just a model of this, what we're talking about here, of reaching out. He says, I'll try to paraphrase it. I know you to be a loving father. I know you've gone through tremendous anguish and pain, and a death of a family member is alluded to, although you don't really know what happened. I know you to be a loving grandfather. You know, I know that you wouldn't, you because of this, you have the capacity to understand what we're asking for, and to know that if we can ask for something that really represents the dignity of our people, that of course you would respond. And it's just, I mean, it just literally brings one to your knees. I mean, you just can't imagine someone in Desmond Tutu's place who'd been beaten and thrown into jail and had his people killed and his closest aides jailed repeatedly, sometimes just to harass him or to make his life more difficult, for him to write this love letter. But it's in the context of I mean, it's not a mushy kind of a letter, but it's deeply, genuinely caring, thoughtful letter that breaks through and does what Martin Luther King so often talked about and modeled. I remember him, after the four girls were killed in one of the churches, giving a sermon saying, you know, those policemen who are out there purportedly protecting the people inside from further violence, you know, but actually they were as much there to prevent a riot or, you know, some kind of disturbance by the blacks. Those people out there are not our enemies. They are our brothers and sisters. We owe it to them to love them and to extend every courtesy to them. And and to suffer blows rather than lift any violence toward them. That our goal is for all of us to move forward as a society that cares for one another. It's not us winning over those people. And again, I mean, just all virtually all of his speeches. There's three of them published in a tiny little booklet that's over in the bookstore that includes a couple of the classics along that line. That was the same that brought him ultimately to oppose the Vietnam War. His incredible capacity to empathize with the enemy and to not allow that to disturb his sense of who he was. And his grounding was in a different place than his race or his ethnicity or his country or his class or his or anything else. It was grounded in the gospel, and it just made all the difference. Other notions here. So I've added at least one thing, but it's peace. To be a peacemaker also is to take practical steps, to learn skills, to understand that nonviolence has a power, it's all its own, that can look as appealing and as effective, just from by hard-nosed analysis, as other forms of getting what you need or want or feel is right, if not greater. In fact, let me expand this one step further. Share one of the great stories of the Wall of Hope and of other efforts to try to grapple with this. There are several illusions that are shattered by this book. One, that nonviolence has no place in Islam. Another, the one that I've just been saying, that nonviolence is limited to people that are kind of peaceful. And thirdly, that nonviolence doesn't work against really determined opposition that's willing to use force regardless of what you do. It's the story of Badsha Khan. Anybody heard of him? Lived in the Khyber Pass area between what's now Afghanistan and Pakistan. A very, very sort of key place geographically, because it's right on the trade route between the Europe and the Far East. And perhaps because of that, in part, the Pathans who live there, or Pathans, are among them, ask any anthropologist, among the most violent or warlike or male, if you will, peoples on Earth. Incredible, the stories about them. And this one of their leaders, Badsha Khan, had heard about Gandhi, and he had no interest in nonviolence. But he heard that this fellow had a particularly acute understanding of power. And he traveled and visited Gandhi and learned some things, learned a few more things. Long story short, became a convert to nonviolence, took Gandhi's theories back to his own people, taught them to others, organized teams of people that would travel anywhere in the region and resolve conflicts, leave their weapons at home, and simply interpose their bodies and their courage and bring people to the bargaining table, as you will. And I'm not just talking about 5 or 10 of his best friends. I mean, he trained his whole people. I mean, all of the warriors that fought for him ended up, or most all, I would imagine, a few of them said, this is ridiculous, I'm out of here. But an astonishingly large number of them ended up trained, disciplined, nonviolent activists, much like the inner core of Martin Luther King or Gandhi's folks. In fact, there were moments in the struggle against the British where he had 100,000 trained nonviolent activists, disciplined, without arms, without weapons, standing up against them. And story after story in this book and other books of that his people had a kind of a garment that the leaders wore that was red, and the British came in and they were going to get rid of this thorn in their flesh who had stopped so many things from happening, and they started killing people with that red jacket on. And this old man, one of the village elders that had long since retired, he was too feeble to get along, jumped down and grabbed the coat off of one of the people that had just been killed and put it on and stood in front of the soldiers and got killed, or attacked himself. I don't know if he died from it, but just incredible courage to say, we won't submit to the British, but we're also not going to fight you. And many, many fewer people died. Far from being impractical, nonviolence typically results in far fewer casualties than violence. One of the tragedies of our history books is that we have a double standard. If 10,000 people die in a war, well, that's war. But if 100 people or 50 people or 10 people are killed in a nonviolent conflict or struggle, that proves that nonviolence doesn't work. And one of the great contributions of many of this book that I've recommended, Walter Wink's Engaging the Powers, is that he helps unmask some of the some of the unfairness or inadequacy of the way in which we evaluate nonviolence versus violent techniques, and I'm not finding the page I'm looking for. I have to go on shorter hikes. Here it is. It'd be fun to put it up, but I'll just read it. You can write it down if you'd like. In the 1500s, 1.6 million people were killed in wars. In the 1600s, 6.1 million people were killed. In the 1700s, 7 million. In the 1800s, 19.4 million. In the 1900s so far, 107.8 million people have been killed in wars. And for anybody to say about any nonviolent effort, it obviously doesn't work. These five people died, or these eight people just broke down and used their fist against the cops, or some agent provocateurs came in and disrupted it and made it look like it was violent, or 1,000 people submitted to arrest, but these 20 over there bolted or never were part of the group and they were violent. I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable how so often the media just doesn't understand what nonviolence is all about. I mean, many times they'll use the phrase or the word nonviolence to mean simply that there wasn't violence, which isn't at all what it means, right? I mean, Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and Tolstoy and Thoreau and everybody else means by nonviolence a whole different philosophy, a whole different understanding of power and your relationship to the other, a whole different understanding of conflict, and a whole lot of discipline that leads you through to a point where you can deal with conflicts in a way that doesn't require violence. And yet, I bet 3/4, 4/5, 90/10 of the journalists today would use nonviolent without even thinking to simply describe something where nobody got killed. And there's such a poverty of understanding in our culture that it's no great miracle that that there isn't more utilization of the real power of nonviolence, which doesn't just mean refraining from hitting somebody, but it means a whole philosophy, a whole perspective that has real power to it. And similarly, it's proved us almost incapable of understanding the Bible. One of my favorite parts of the same text that the Beatitudes are in, and it's, why don't we just turn to it? I have it in here. Anybody else up here would like a Bible? I want to just see if anybody else wants a Bible, just raise your hands. Let's take a look at it, because there's a couple stories in here that are really great in and of themselves, but when you just think about the situation of the Jews at the time, another whole level of power is reinvested in the text. And we're talking about Matthew 5, beginning in like 38 or 39. Somebody want to read that when people have enough? Yeah, please.
38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You want the love your enemies part?
That's fine. We'll get to that, I hope. Let's just take one or two of these. Let's take the walking a mile. Anyone force you to go a mile? Anybody understand what's the context of this? What every one of his hearers would be thinking when he tells this encouragement or shares this strategy?
The Roman soldiers could compel anyone to carry their their armor on my own.
Right, yeah. You can imagine, Roman soldiers had to carry everything with them. Their packs and their armor all together was quite heavy. And like any conquering or imperial or colonial army, it was very easy for them to just grab someone off the side of the street and say, okay, you're going to carry my pack for a while. I mean, that's totally understandable. And they happened in Vietnam all the time, if you talk to anyone who was there. The Romans, however, had a problem on their hands. You do that sort of thing too much. Take over people's houses, steal their chickens, make them carry your stuff, and you're going to have a revolt on your hands. So there's ample secular historical records of the regulations that were set down for soldiers. Just like U.S. soldiers were told by their officers in Vietnam. They did all kinds of things to try to keep that sort of instinctive or natural or at least typical behavior of soldiers, pretty rough folks by and large, right, the stereotype, and also their position of power in the society, and just their sense of burden, you know, that they'll take it out on the oppressed or the colonial people. So they'd set down regulations, and one of the regulations is you can't make someone carry your armor more than a mile. So at least they're leaving their own stuff by the roadside, they won't be totally out of sight by and large, or they can get back to it pretty quick. And you're not going to push these people over the edge to revolt, which is going to be much more costly for us. We're going to have to bring in additional troops. We're going to suffer casualties. Let's keep this under control. Every one of the hearers of this text understood that. And in fact, when he said the second part of it, I can just picture what happened. There a ripple of laughter went through as people thought about it. Yes. What kind of position am I putting this fellow who's got all of this control over me, who's oppressing me, who thinks he's getting away with something? If I say, oh no, that's okay, I'll carry it another mile. I mean, just think of the larger and stronger and more powerful Roman soldier in your mind, the better, right? He's really in a spot. Because if he says, oh, okay, he can suffer disciplinary action. And the discipline attached to these, and again, from secular records, was not like a... Christ was offering, was a kind of a jiu-jitsu, right? I mean, it was offering an oppressed people power, but a wholly different kind of a power, the kind of power that both asserts your dignity without hurting the other person, and at the same time, turning the tables, like making evident, putting out onto the table your dignity. It's not just that you're keeping it to yourself. It's not the kind of stereotype of just being passive or only listening to other people, as important as those are. It's active nonviolence of the purest form. I mean, it's brilliant. And we could spend the rest of the evening, really, till midnight, going through biblical texts and with ironclad understanding of the text, not just like playing fast and loose with the text, come to understand Christ as offering strategies of nonviolence to his people. And the early church understood this. I mean, the early church is almost an embarrassment to efforts to construct like a Lutheran statement on peace in the 20th century. I mean, they really ignored the overwhelming support for pacifism and for sharing economically and for breaking down some of the barriers and boundaries between classes and races and so forth that we've come to accept or say that, well, you know, you ought to be loving in it over and above those, rather than actually dismantling them. The one about giving the cloak, again, just it's indisputable among scholars of the period that shame of nakedness was not the person who didn't have clothes on. The shame was in the person that was looking. Actually, kind of an advanced view of it when you come to think of it. Pornography. The shame ought to be on the viewer, not on the participant, right? But that we're not even talking about that. We're just talking about nakedness, right? So if someone is going to steal your coat or take your coat, and you offer your cloak as well, and that's it in the Middle Eastern garb, you're sort of putting them in a very, very difficult position. It's more of that sort of moral or psychological or conflictual jujitsu.
And it's in a court situation. Mm-hmm. He wants to sue you.
Right, and that, so and of course, this would be the generic term. The specific thing is a little more complicated. Levitical law said that if you owed someone money and they took your outer garment as kind of collateral for to pay for the debt temporarily, they had to give it back to you at night so you had something to sleep in. I mean, most people just used that, their sort of heavier coat, as the what they slept in, what kept them warm at night. And it was part of the generosity and brilliance, really, of early Hebrew law. Again, in contrast to much of the Middle East, to put real strict limits on those sorts of things. I mean, the whole idea of Jubilee, you know, every 7 years you forgive debts, every 50 years you just throw everything back in the middle and you're back, everybody starts back from zero. I mean, that's a kind of a preposterous idea to modern economic thinking. I mean, how could you run an economy like that? Well, in fact, maybe that's a better way. Just nobody could dream of even considering that or debating that or discussing that in our modern context. In fact, I would love to see someone come up with, in fact, and there may be already more than the beginnings of that in the Kairos group that is talking about this Jubilee concept in trying to think of practical ways to put that out into the public. Does that make sense? And there's numerous other examples of this in the Bible where Christ would do this kind of a jujitsu isn't even fair, but it's sort of turning the tables in a way that doesn't totally embarrass the opponent. It's not really designed just for, you know, one-upmanship like on television, you know, where someone does something, some witty remark, you know, that turns the tables on someone. It's actually, it visually and dramatically illustrates that we're equal, that I have my rights, that and sort of reveals that you've been oppressing me by having me carry this for the first mile. Yeah.
I think it's forgiveness too. When someone deliberately does something to you,
uh-huh.
and you through Christ can forgive that person.
Yes.
Yes. I understand.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's really exactly it. That it illustrates the change of heart that doesn't see the opponent as enemy, but it also expresses your own dignity. It doesn't. It's not passivism, you know, like lying down and letting somebody walk on you, which is really the stereotype of nonviolence or the peacemaker. I mean, you imagine, you know, St. Francis of Assisi with the doves, you know, or the birds landing on his arms and holding the lamb, right? How many of you were here for the story about St. Francis a couple days ago? I should tell it again then. My favorite story about St. Francis. He's going on the Crusades, you know, he's a committed Christian. Right from the beginning he had misgivings, of course, and it doesn't take long to realize that there's an awful lot of looting and raping and slaughter and pillage involved. It's not just taking back, you know, Jerusalem and Bethlehem from the enemy. And so St. Francis and one of his buddies go to their own commander, this cardinal, and say, why don't we see if we can negotiate something? I mean, if war's been going on this long, they might be getting tired of it too. And cardinal says, no dice. I mean, of course, he's not out there in the front line sweating and bleeding. So St. Francis and his friend cross the lines, get themselves captured in a way that might allow them to actually appear before the Sultan. The Sultan hears that there's some people that want to talk to him and talk peace, doesn't believe him, so he beats the crap out of him. I mean, tortures him, figuring, you know, these are spies, they'll break. I mean, spies, particularly as bedraggled as these two, and as unlikely looking that they would be, you know, really disciplined kinds of spies. And lo and behold, they still are talking peace at the end of it, and there's something undeniable about the kind of integrity and power in their personality. True story, apparently. Brings them before the Sultan. They work out a deal. Like, what would constitute peace for you? What would you be willing to give up to the Crusaders to bring peace. So he lays out like access to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and the holy sites and so forth, and all of the other kinds of things that were the rhetoric of the Crusades. St. Francis and his buddy go back, present the shuttle diplomacy results to the higher-ups, and they say, no dice, you know. Where will we be then? You know, we got a crusade going here. This is good, you know. We're making money, looting homes and so forth. Crusades, to the end of their efforts on a military level, never achieved more than the offer of the Sultan to St. Francis. Now that's nonviolence. Not just the sort of meek and mild picture of St. Francis. You know, as wonderful as St. Francis's love for animals is, and you know, blessing pets one day a year, it's a great idea. Should have happened long ago, or longer ago, or whatever. We should do more of it in our churches. But there's something really powerful about many of these people. We could go on and on. I mean, many of the secular folks that we know of as heroes, like Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks and others, there's much more in their story than what little has sort of percolated into the stories that are part of their kind of plaster saint status in our society today. And there's a wonderful world of discovery for us and for our children and for our classrooms in sharing those stories, because they do a number of things. They really help teach the kinds of elements of peacemaking that we've talked about here. And they'll work in the secular world too, virtually all of it will. But they also, I think, can be very valuable in a larger kind of a context of claiming the dignity of everyone, regardless of race and class and ethnic group and so forth, of sharing the genuine power of a world where you're not dominating over other people, but where you're sharing, where your dignity is not based in your superior financial status or your power, but in your grounding in Christ, really. And that's the gospel. I mean, that is the new way that Christ was presenting. I mean, it's a lot of things, but it's ironic that we've often been preaching a gospel that's only half of it. You know, that sounds like it's only a kind of a magical forgiveness sort of a deal. I love Walt Bowman's anecdote about that, how Lutherans have distorted that gospel, this easy arrangement that so many Lutherans have. God seems to like to forgive, I like to sin. And it's like nothing changes. And again, going back to Bonhoeffer's notion of cheap grace and costly grace, that it was just one of the tragedies that the Lutheran tradition lost sight of the agony and the struggle that Luther went through to find justification. And in some of his sermons, he wasn't able to or assumed on a part of his hearers that struggle. They knew it, but didn't take too long before that part got dropped out and people were grasping at something that was just a terrible distortion. That it was, well, Bonhoeffer puts it briefer than I will anyway. Cheap grace means the justification of sin, not the justification of the sinner. Grace alone does everything, they say, and so everything can remain as it is. Cheap grace is the grace we bestow on ourselves. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ, living and incarnate.
What I notice here in this part of the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus begins with the general statement, you know, don't retaliate against evil. But then the kind of examples, as you explain them, that not only standing up in a kind of dignified way, but there is a kind of a practical protest element, using even the powers that are there, you know, so that using this public court system to show how I've been treated unjustly, you know, or to use, as you said, you know, the Roman rules for the soldiers, you know, and to kind of push
the point, and there's a protest element there. So, yes, the non-retaliation is crucial, but there's
yes
power to the
it's and it would be and more accurate to say non like lethal or non violent retaliation. I mean, it's that's why Martin words the non-violence, because people just couldn't understand it, like active non-violence or civil disobedience. So that it was clear that we're talking about an active process, not a passive or doormat kind of a process. It's a process for courageous people. You know, it's a process to struggle for what is right, not a process to allow wrong to triumph. And, you know, they're just, again, just to remind ourselves of the kinds of stories. I mean, the one that we told Monday in the Bonhoeffer discussion of the pastor that gets arrested and the choir practice meets and they say, you know, what are we singing here for? I have an idea. Let's go sing in front of the Gestapo prison. And by the time they get there, there's twice as many choir members as on an average Sunday. And the Gestapo is totally nonplussed. They have not a clue what to do with a whole group of people singing. I mean, if it was a third as many with guns to storm the place and free their pastor, that they could have handled. But they just couldn't deal with, and you could just see them stand, you know, sort of shifting around up there with their hands folded. I mean, you know, and I'm not making this up. I mean, at the end of the war, Allies interviewed officers in the German military to find out, like, what are the lessons we can learn from this? And just in-depth interviews, thousands and thousands of hours of interviews. And one of the lessons was that the Germans, upper leadership, repeatedly said, you know, it was very, very difficult to handle effective guerrilla forces like Tito and Yugoslavia and so forth. But you know what really baffled us? The nonviolent protests in Norway and Denmark, Romania, Bulgaria, etc., Holland. I mean, that was the hard stuff. And in fact, just to pick one of those countries, I mean, the folks in Denmark that were in charge of the German occupation were for months sending the word back, let's just get out of here. We're not getting as much out of this country in terms of raw materials or cheap labor or whatever that as it costs for us to occupy these people. There's a much more powerful way of resisting oppression than military force, was what was the conclusion. And so the irony is, here we have the charge, the response to those of us that have been saying, hey, maybe nonviolence might actually work in the world. The one thing, or an example of the kind of question that we would get thrown back at us that we could never answer in the past, or it felt like it was the impossible, and what do you do with the Hitler? And it turns out that even the most difficult to respond to story or example, Hitler, the nonviolent responses to Hitler were more effective than the violent ones were. In country after country, occupation after occupation, people power in the Philippines nonviolently toppled one of the most ruthless, brutal governments in history. I mean, Marcos has few peers. And people in Eastern Europe who had been organizing and meeting secretly and not so secretly for years were glued to their television sets and to the newspaper reports that came out of that. And much of their strategy was really building on that. I mean, that sole young man in his white shirt and his bag of groceries or produce or whatever it was, standing in front of a line of tanks in Tiananmen Square, coming in to kill the students, and he stands in front of them, they don't know what to do. And so they finally just, takes a while for four tanks to back up, but they do, and they sort of move around, and he waits until they're just ready to move forward, and he just moves over in front of them again. And it was an image that went around the world, and yet, American media, it's almost like they never saw it. I mean, U.S. media, reporters, commentators, on television, in print, etc., it's almost like these revolutions never happened. I mean, nearly a third of the entire world's population have been involved in, by and large, successful
or totally successful or largely successful changes of their whole political environment, illustrating the power of nonviolence. And it's like it almost didn't happen. Neither the Christians are getting up and saying, yeah, this is what we've been saying all along. This is what Christ is talking about. Nor, and even worse, the secular media are just ignoring it. At least like the Lutheran statement, you know, encourages congregations to teach nonviolence. I mean, there were enough people in the Lutheran discussion about peace to say, this is central to the gospel. This is crucial for our understanding of our faith. You know, that faith is not just this one-dimensional forgiveness of sins kind of thing, but it's a transformation of our lives. It's an offering of a new life, now as well as later, and in all of the dimensions of life. And again, I mean, the prophets railed against people who were clinging to fasting or other kinds of religious ritual, you know, or as Christ says, leave your gift at the altar, go and make peace with your brethren, and then come back. I mean, what can be more explicit than that? And yet, it's again, there are many pastors and congregations that it's like Christ never said that. It's black and white that the gospel is that reconciliation. That's part of, it's intimately connected with forgiveness of sins. And in fact, that's the new life that Christ is offering us here and now, a way for us to engage the most difficult, painful, conflictual aspects of our world. We are here to be healers. And those that understand that, that accept that promise, not just, it's, Christ isn't just pushing us into the fray. He's saying, we have a great new way to deal with this stuff. And it actually works. I've shown you numerous times. And the people that accept that discipleship are the children of God. You know, that one of the characterizations that is sort of as close as you can get to Christ. I mean, Christ is the Son of God. And he's saying you are Christ in that moment. In the same way that when you see that hungry person and you feed that person, you are feeding Christ. I mean, that's as close as we can get to Christ. And I mean, there's a reason why the Bonhoeffers and the Martin Luther Kings, you know, faced threats to their life with the kind of courage that they did. Because they had internalized that. They had understood that, you know, that I am resting in the arms of Christ. Not in some superficial, like Hallmark card sort of level, but because I have understood my relationship both to Christ and also to my fellow human beings. I am participating in a kind of discipleship that makes life worthwhile, that it was like black and white before and it's color now. And the kind of joy, people watched Bonhoeffer walk to the gallows and said, you know, I've never known anyone that seemed to be in the presence of God like Bonhoeffer. I've never, he looked like the warden and everyone else were the people in jail. And he was clearly the person that had the most power in the room. And they've said that about Bonhoeffer, about Gandhi, and about Dorothy Day, and about Martin Luther King, and about a whole lot of the other people. I mean, there's a secret here. These people are revealing something that Christ was talking about all along. Bonhoeffer's grandmother, how many were here for the Bonhoeffer? I hate to tell the stories over and over again, but Bonhoeffer's grandmother, one of the very first acts a few weeks after Hitler assumed power was a boycott of Jewish businesses. And you can just see Hitler testing, how far will anti-Semitism take me? You know, how can I sort of rally people around scapegoating one group rather than noticing where the real problem is? And so he, not personally, but I believe it was through other folks, called this boycott of all Jewish businesses. Bonhoeffer's grandmother, 5'1" or so, very diminutive, you know, dresses up as nicely as possible, her shawl around her shoulders, and just picture her marching right through the lines of the police and of the brown shirts with their sticks and so forth, keeping people out, into the store, loads up a big bag of produce, pays for it, comes back out. What would have happened if that had happened, you know, with a third of the stores in all of Germany? I mean, that would have been the end of the use of that scapegoating tactic. Let's just finish. What time are we at?
It's about 7:27.
Oh, goodness. Let's conclude with that verse 43 to 45. In fact, just the first phrase of 45. Anybody have it there? Is anybody ready to read it, or should I?
I am. Is it
43? Mm-hmm.
You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven.
I'm going to leave you with a challenge. I'm not to the point very often or in my life where I love my enemies. I work at it, and I think that's an important task. But I'm gonna invite you to join me in the challenge that I've laid to myself, to wrestle with that, struggle with that, but to make as one of my central goals to love everyone I serve on a committee with or work with. With understanding, with listening, with not rising to the bait, with developing my skill to do that, and to forgive. And 75 times 7 is just not in my kind of ballpark at this point. My goal is to forgive someone at least 7 times before I come to the conclusion that I have a right to beat up on them and talk behind their back and sort of hate inwardly and think that I'm superior. So at least 7 times. And maybe by the turn of the millennia, I'll be up to 70 times. And I'll be in touch with you in many ways if I get to 75 times 7. So that's my invitation to you. I think it's obvious. I mean, Christ, I think, is offering us something, not just making our lives more difficult. And I look forward to a full report on what happens to those of you that pick up my challenge. Thank you very much.